Blog Talk Radio.
Down here to win championships. Not one, championships.
Not two.
LeBron, tell us about that.
Not two, not three, not four, not five, not six, not seven.
Welcome to this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. I'm your host, Cyril Quinn, taking you for the next 90 minutes, a busy program on this 9th of June, 2012, 31 minutes after the 10 o'clock hour. Again, we're taking you to noon today, 90 minutes, a lot to do. Kind of a letdown considering what happened with I'll Have Another being out of Belmont, but we'll certainly talk a lot about that with our buddy Alex Brown at around 11 o'clock. I'll talk about how the race stands now, who's the favorite, who will win, who should win, who will win. And things of that nature. But we're going to begin in the National Basketball Association Game 7 between the Heat and the Celtics, a game that will change the course of these franchises moving forward. I mean, one of these eras is going to be over. Celtics lose. They're gonna break that group up without question. They're gonna trade one if not two of those pieces. Who knows? They could trade, they could trade Pierce. They could not re-sign Garnett. They can move Allen and then go from there. They have plenty of, Danny Ainge. One thing he has done is put them in a position to where they'll have plenty of cap space moving forward to get a free agent, whether it be a Darren Williams or whoever, in terms of rebuilding. Or what they want to call it, reloading. It'll be rebuilding. For the Heat, which is the far more intriguing story, because the Celtics have had their run. They've already won a championship, been to the finals twice, and really this run has lasted longer than I thought it would ever last, to be honest with you. But for the Heat, a loss here, and the question is, well, you have two questions. Number one, who gets moved? And number two, Will they ever win the championship? Spoelstra will be gone, you would think. And it will be a matter of, Chris Bosh or Dwayne Wade. They will not come back. Neither one of these teams is coming back as currently constructed for the 2012-2013 season. And this is how it should. I mean, this is, watching that game six, as LeBron is just, doing whatever he wanted to do, and he basically single-handedly beat the Celtics. I mean, nobody else on the Heat played spectacularly or they were okay. He basically single-handedly, beat the Celtics by himself. But watching that game, and as much as I hate the Heat, I really wasn't disappointed by the result, considering that, you're going to see a game seven with everything on the line. And I mean everything on the line for these two franchises, in particular the Heat. Again, the Celtics, you know, nobody's, if the Celtics lose this game by 100 points, nobody's going to, you can't knock the Celtics. I mean, you can't. Just the fact that they're here speaks volumes of about their franchise and about particular, you know, Doc Rivers and Kevin Garnett. And, of course, and not to leave Rajon Rondo out as well. But, for the Heat, and, you know, that's why I had, you know, people, classic overstatement, overreaction to LeBron's performance. Like, yeah, he had a wonderful game. He did exactly what he was supposed to do, as far as I'm concerned. And he played great. I have not had a problem with LeBron throughout the course of this entire series. I think he's been the one constant for the Miami Heat. Everybody else has been, you know, all over the place. Something in particular, Dwayne Wade, from half to half. LeBron's been great throughout the course of the series. Haven't had a problem with him at all. But if he goes out there and the Heat lose this game, you know, he can't win for losing. I mean, if the Heat lose this game, I don't care if he scores 100. He's going to get killed. And if he goes out there and, you know, goes 9 for 23 and doesn't impact the game in the fourth quarter and the Heat lose, he's going to get destroyed. So that's the life of the self-proclaimed, you know, king, you know, or chosen one. I think, again, I'll stick with this. If the game is close, Celtics win. If the game is within two possessions, and I mean within 6 points in the fourth quarter, within 3 to 6 points in the fourth quarter, the Celtics will win this game. History, of course, is on the Heat side. Listen, 88-22 is the record of the home teams all time in game sevens. That's a win percentage of 80%. There's a reason why that, you know, that is, because normally the home team is the better team based on their record. But, you know, these games can also a lot of times turn into an avalanche where home team gets out to a hot start and runs for cover. Celtics can withstand that initial burst from the Heat and keep this, and, you know, like I said, keep this within a possession or two, they're going to win this game. Because executing down the stretch, handling fourth quarter pressure, making big plays, you have to take the Celtics. You have to take the Celtics. Look at the games the Heat have won in this series. Game one, you know, blowout. Even game two, which the Celtics, game two is the one game that they could have, that they won closer, that was close, that they did win, but they had nothing to do with execution. You know, that was, to me, that was just one of those, you know, Paul Pierce fouls out, a couple calls go against the Celtics' way. They outlasted the Celtics in that game. I didn't think they out-executed them. They outlasted them. And, of course, last game, you know, game six was over by, basically over by halftime. Celtics have to get something out of Paul Pierce, though. I mean, Paul Pierce, I understand you're guarding LeBron James. I get that you're not going to outscore LeBron James. You have to stay on the court. He doesn't really understand the court. That, to me, is the key for the Celtics. What I think Rondo will play well. I think Garnett will play well. But Paul Pierce, to me, is the X factor if the Celtics want to move forward. A lot to do on this busy Saturday morning. Maria Sharapova is about to win the French Open. She's up 6-3, 5-2 in the second set, though she is down break point, but this match is basically over, so we'll certainly talk about that over the course of the show. Of course, she had the men's final, Nadal and Djokovic. So a busy Saturday. When we come back, we'll have some Saturday morning headlines. Again, Alex Brown coming up at the top of the hour. We'll be right back on this latest edition of the Saturday morning wake-up call. Welcome back to this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call. Sharapova blows another championship point. She's blown two of them. She is up 5-2 at deuce in the second set. So Sharapova trying to complete the career Grand Slam. She's had a very interesting career, to say the least. She's going to end up in the Tennis Hall of Fame without question. I mean, it's a big deal when you win all four tournaments. But we'll talk about it later. She's had an intriguing career, I think. Never been dominant, but we'll certainly get to that when she indeed does close out this match. Of course, the big news of the morning is Al have another out of the Belmont Stakes, forced to retire with a left tendon injury. Everything, you know, I was looking so forward to this. This is a huge letdown for me in terms of, you know, wanting to see a Triple Crown winner in my lifetime. I wasn't even born the last time they had a Triple Crown winner. I mean, 1978, where I was born, but having certainly probably June of 1978. We had been close a number of times in recent years. Matter of fact, we hadn't had a horse that had a chance to win the Triple Crown since 2008. Of course, Big Brown, who finished last at the Belmont Stakes 4 years ago. So I definitely was looking forward to I'll have another and seeing if this horse can indeed, as Sharapova has just won the French Open and completed a career Grand Slam, see if this horse can indeed finish the deal. And listen, it has not been a great week for New York racing in general. There was just a whole bunch of stuff, negative stuff, leading up to this. I mean, you had the situation where the labor workers, you know, I know they reached an agreement with the New York State Racing Association in terms of benefits and things of that nature. You know, Doug O'Neill, who I don't know even how he's even racing. I don't even know how he's even in the sport right now. All the violations that he's had in terms of being accused of doping horses with the carbon monoxide, juicing horses with the carbon monoxide, the whole nine, and you know Belmont deciding to put all the horses in one barn, the barn being called a detention center. A lot of owners, trainers have a problem with that. So there have been a number of things that have just been leading up to this, and it was all getting capped off yesterday morning when they announced that the favorite, who was a 4-5 favorite, I'll have another, not only is done for the race, but he's going to be retired with a left tendon injury. So it'll be very interesting to see what Alex Brown has to say about in terms of the atmosphere. I've read articles that people are saying that there will probably be 20,000 to 30,000 less people at the Belmont than there would have been, considering this, you know, possible historic event. Is it a great thing for racing, considering that had this horse won the Triple Crown, a lot of people have been questioning how legitimate it is, considering all the speculation around Doug O'Neill, who, again, you know, let's be honest, doesn't have the greatest reputation in the horse racing industry as far as, you know, racing clean horses. As I just mentioned, Maria Sharapova has won the French Open. Sharapova now completes a career Grand Slam, her fourth Grand Slam. She's won one of each now. And, you know, she's had a very interesting career. And I say that because, number one, she's absolutely going to the Tennis Hall of Fame. I mean, there are players it's not hard to get to the Tennis Hall of Fame, first of all, which is crazy to me. But she's won four majors, won the career Grand Slam. Oh, look at her majors, and look how spread out they are. She beat Serena Williams at Wimbledon in 2004. Then 2 years later, she won the U.S. Open, 06. Then in 08, she won the Australian Open. And now, 4 years later, she wins the French Open. Sharapova, to me, has never been a dominant player. She's never been, you know, the other times where she has been ranked number one, whatever with that, because the points, you know, point system in men's and women's tennis in terms of who's ranked number one, really, I don't follow it at all. All I go by is who's winning majors and who's not. She's never been, I mean, you know, the dominant players in this era in terms of women's tennis have been Serena Williams, Justine Henin, Kim Clijsters, Venus Williams. Those have been the dominant players of this era. You know, Hingis to a much lesser extent. Hingis. Sharapova's kind of, you know, floated along, won some tournaments, stayed in the top five, top four rankings. You know, done some, you know, been a celebrity. But I would never consider her to be a great, great player. But yet she just, you know, completed a career Grand Slam. You know, again, she'll be in the Hall of Fame without question. But I don't consider, like, in terms of her contemporaries, in terms of some of the all-time greats that I've seen, she doesn't even come close. I mean, to a Martina, to a Steffi Graf, or even Monica Seles, for that matter. She's not even on the same, you know, stratosphere as those players. So, but with that being said, she is the 2012 French Open champion, winning in straight sets. And look who she beat. She beat a girl who, basically, if you're not a tennis buff, you never even heard of her. The Saints have hired former FBI Director Louis Freeh to investigate the club in terms of the bounties, the bounty investigation. I don't understand, you know, Tom Benson. I don't know if Tom Benson is just trying to show trying to get in the good graces of Roger Goodell. I don't get the point of this. I mean, the NFL has dug enough dirt to where your coach is suspended for a season. You have your defensive coordinator may never coach in the NFL again. You know, your general manager is done for half the season. And you're going to conduct a further investigation into your own doing. I don't get it. I don't get what the Saints are doing with this. Trust me. The NFL does not need help in terms of finding dirt. This is what they do. They don't need help. They found 50,000 pages worth of documentation, okay, on the Saints and the bounties. June 18th, you know, Goodell is going to, the players are going to have their chance to have their say June 18th against Goodell. I mean, good luck with that. But I just don't get the Saints, you know, trying to all of a sudden police themselves. It's a little late for that, to be honest with you. It's a little late. 48 minutes after the 10 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. When we return, we'll talk a little baseball. Steven Strasburg starring in Boston, and Johan Santana gets rocked. We'll talk about that and much, much more on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. We'll be right back. Welcome back to this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call, 50 minutes after the 10 o'clock hour. As always, the call number is 347-215-6180. You can follow me at follow me on Twitter at William Jurrell. You can also hit me up on Facebook.com/TheRealQuinn or find me in my latest blog or latest audio at SurrealGeraldQuinn.com. As we talked about earlier, you know, Roger Goodell will meet with the suspended Saints on June 18th. Arbitrator ruled earlier this week on Thursday that Goodell does have the, you know, will have the right to rule on. They had the right to rule on to have the ruling and to rule on, you know, on the matter. And that wasn't going to get switched. I mean, there was no way that was going to get switched. And this decision is not going to get switched. I mean, the players, to me, frankly, are just wasting their time. You know, Goodell is the judge and jury, and that's just the way it is. I mean, it's, you know, if you're a player, if you're a coach, if you're somebody in the NFL, you just have to accept that. I mean, there's nothing that's going to change that. You know, Goodell is the most powerful man in sports, the most powerful commissioner in sports without question, and he runs a league where the most powerful league in sports. So, you know, he can do what he wants. I mean, basically, that's bottom line. He can do what he wants. A great weekend of interleague baseball play. Boston and Washington, good win for the Nats, 7-4. Strasburg strikes out 13. Red Sox, Harper, you know, not a home run for him. That, you know, the Nationals could go up there. If they can go up there and get 2 out of 3, that'd be a great job by them. Still, I know the Sox, Red Sox have struggled in Fenway Park this year, but it's still a tough place to play. Still following the, you know, American League rules. Again, Strasburg was just phenomenal, and like, you know, I'm having this discussion with somebody yesterday. There's no way, and I mean no way, that the Nationals can sit this guy down over the course of and hold him to 160 innings. You just can't do it. And be in the middle of a pennant race. The Nationals aren't going anywhere. I mean, they're, to me, from top to bottom, you can make a case that they are the best team in the National League. I mean, there's somebody up there, right there with the Dodgers, Reds, Cardinals, whoever you want to toss up there, you know, whoever you want to toss up there, they're right there. But with that pitching, that starting pitching, with the pitching, I would say that they are the best team in the National League. And their offense, once their offense comes together, you know, they'll really be able to take off, and they have money to spend to make a move at the All-Star break. But you cannot sell that to your fan base that, hey, you know, we're gonna shut it down. We're gonna shut Steven down, you know, until next season in the middle of a pennant race. I mean, especially right now he's a Cy Young winner. I mean, he's 8-1 right now. He's been the dominant pitcher in the league. You're shutting down the Cy Young winner, right? If you were to do this, there's no question he's a Cy Young winner. I know Capono and, you know, Gio Gonzalez pitched well, and a couple other guys, you know, in the National League. Kane has been great, but nobody from the beginning of the season up at this point, maybe even in all of baseball, Cole Hamels has been great as well, has pitched as good as Steven Strasburg. Yankees have their way with the Mets, 9-1. Yankees really knocked around Johan Santana, and obviously speculation we're going to talk about. Speculation is going to be on, you know, the 130-some-odd pitches. He did get an extra day. He was coming off 6 days rest. Listen, you know, pitchers can get knocked around. I mean, even the great Justin Verlander had lost like 3 straight starts. And this guy is the best pitcher in baseball. So I'm not going to go too crazy about Johan Santana and about this start. He could have got hit on 10 days of rest. The Yankees historically have hit Santana, especially in that ballpark, in New Yankee Stadium. So I don't think it's a big deal. Yankees have been playing well of late. They're right in the middle of that crazy race in American League East, where everybody's in there. You know, everybody's in that race. We'll talk about that a little bit. over the course of the show, but everybody seems to be in that race. Texas shuts out San Francisco 5-0. Texas exercising a couple demons, beating the Giants, who manhandled them in the World Series 2 years ago. I want to say swept. They didn't sweep them, but it was 4-1, and Giants dominated that series. But the big last night, you had, of course, a six-pitcher no-hitter with Seattle shutting out the Dodgers 1-0, getting six pitches as they had. They brought out Mike Casillas here at the French Open. I guess the trophy presentation. I'm assuming was it 20 years since she won her first French Open. I'm assuming that might be the occasion. But there's, you know, Mike Casillas out there to probably present Maria Sharapova with the trophy. Seattle, you're using six pitchers, starting out with Kevin Millwood to shut out the Dodgers 1-0. Millwood, you know, who has to be close to 40 years old, amazingly still pitching. And has, and by the way, has pitched a no-hitter, still pitching for the Seattle Mariners again. They get another no-hitter. I believe this is the fourth one this year in baseball. You have Tampa Bay over Miami. Yeah, Tampa Bay over Miami. So, again, some good interleague play. The Phillies knocked around Baltimore. Some good interleague matchups. There was a lot of talk I was watching that Mets-Yankees game that just, you know, that it seemed like both teams were tired of meeting up against each other. And there could be a possibility that next year when Houston goes to the American League that the Yankees and Mets only meet up three times. Only played one series. And listen, the 2000 World Series destroyed that whole Subway Series and the aura and the whole, you know, mystique in terms of that. They met in the World Series. It was like it can't get any bigger than this, and it couldn't. So, they've met almost, you know, basically 95 times now. You know, the crowd was good. The crowd was a little subdued. I mean, it wasn't nowhere near the excitement that you first heard, you know, back in 97 or even up to 2000. You know, from 97 to 2000, it was a zoo out there, basically, in terms of the crowds. Crowds were wild. Now, I know old Yankee Stadium blows away new Yankee Stadium in terms of crowd noise, but, you know, it's just not the same thing as far as the NLD play goes. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now joined by Alex Brown, who certainly, like myself, has to be devastated by the news of I'll Have Another. Alex, thanks for joining the program. How are you doing this morning?
Thank you for having me. And like you say, I was really looking forward to seeing if I'll Have Another was good enough to win the Triple Crown. And unfortunately, we heard yesterday that he's retired, which, you know, kind of shocked us all and has definitely changed the nature of this horse race.
Oh, no question about it, Alex. Alex, I mentioned earlier in the program that there had been just a number of just strange events, not strange, but negative events leading up to this in terms of, you know, the labor talks with the New York State Racing Association and, you know, and Belmont with their workers, Doug O'Neill, his whole, you know, with the whole drugging and, you know, his pending suspension that will start July 1st. Just, you know, it's just been a number of just small things, you know, the barns. Certainly we'll talk about the situation where all the horses have been in the same barn. It being called a detention center, basically, for horses. And it seemed like Friday kind of, you know, I didn't see it coming, but it almost like Friday, it almost like it was a sense of, you know, that was kind of like the tip of the iceberg in terms of what happened with I'll Have Another. It seemed like it was that it almost made sense that happened, considering the whole week in Belmont, in New York, in Belmont as far as this race goes. Talk about that for a second.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, there was a certain sequence of events leading up to this Belmont race that was somewhat distracting, which is a shame because obviously I'll Have Another, I mean, undefeated this year, is a terrific racehorse, but the focus was much less on the horse and much more on some other issues, which really should have been irrelevant in the context of seeing if this horse could win the Triple Crown. But we were distracted by the record of Doug O'Neill. We were distracted by the detention situation, which in of itself probably wasn't a bad thing, but you know, the way it was communicated to the trainers, some last minute stuff, switching things up, was thing, and then you had the work dispute, as you mentioned, just lots of distractions, which was a shame because, again, this did seem like a really, really, really good racehorse, and we were hoping to watch compete this afternoon. And then it came out on Twitter about 11 o'clock that there was going to be a press conference at 1 o'clock given by Doug O'Neill, and as soon as that news came out, you knew exactly what it was going to be. The horse was going to scratch, because why else would you have a press conference? So shortly thereafter, the news leaked out very quickly. It came very clear that he had a left front tendon injury, and straight away the horse is retired. What could he do?
So, yeah, I have to admit, and maybe this is the cynic in me, when I first heard the news, I thought to myself, maybe possibly it could be some funny business, but it sounds to me, based on what you just said, it sounds like this injury was legit, and it was just one of those, you know, Doug O'Neill said it was just one of those freakish injuries that, you know, you can't do anything about. So
you
fully believe that this was a legitimate injury?
I'm sure it's a legitimate injury. I mean, what we don't know, and we have to trust, obviously, Doug O'Neill and his connections that are with the horse, that it occurred in the sense that they described it occurring, I think, maybe on Thursday, that they thought it was something else, and then it reoccurred Friday morning after training, and they made a quick decision. And we have to trust that's the case. What we don't know is, were they working on this issue days leading up to it, hoping that they could recover the leg enough to perform at the Belmont, and then made the decision yesterday that that wasn't going to happen. The cynic in me says that that's a potential scenario, but there's no doubt this horse does have an injury. That there's no other reason why they'd pull him from the Belmont. He was going to be the legitimate favorite, and honestly, if he'd have got beaten at Belmont, I don't think that really would have affected his accomplishments in terms of his value going forward. And after all, what is racing all about is how valuable these horses are as breeding animals at the end of the day. So I don't think they were looking to Dr. Belmont. I just think it's a shame. The timing is awful, because obviously the Belmont was a well-hyped sporting event because the Triple Crown was on the line. If this horse was scratched 2 weeks ago, then the buzz for the Belmont wouldn't be anything like it was up till yesterday. And I'm sure a lot of people are kind of a little bit bummed now that maybe they've made commitments to go, or, you know, NBC committed a lot of resources to the race. And honestly, probably the viewership is going to be much smaller than they had anticipated.
Oh, no question. I read something in the Times this morning that, you know, there are some people who, you know, frequent the Belmont a lot, frequently go to the Belmont year after year, who said that they wouldn't be surprised if there were 30,000 less fans there.
Yeah. I'm sure the fans will drop. I mean, whether the number of fans is significantly less or not, certainly there'll be people that paid over the odds for tickets that are going to regret having paid that price at this point, because, you know, it's still a great horse race, I will say that, but it's just another grade one 3-year-old race now. It really doesn't have any more significance than that. But nevertheless, it is still, I would say, as a horse racing fan, this remains a very good horse race. A lot of times the Belmont, you know, the horses that run in the Derby or the Preakness, they kind of fallen by the wayside. Good horses don't typically come back in the Belmont. But I would tell you today we have two or three very good horses in this race. We just don't happen to have the horse that won the Derby in the Preakness.
You have, now I know this is probably isn't a moot point now, but I'll ask it anyway. Where did you, you know, as in comparisons to horses who have failed to win the Triple Crown, who have came up short recently, how does I'll Have Another compare to, say, Smarty Jones, a Big Brown, Funny Side, Real Quiet?
Honestly,
Spectacular Bid, Horses.
Yeah, I mean, you're reading out a list of who's who in horse racing. So to recognize that I'll Have Another competes with those kind of horses is to say he was an incredible horse. Who ever thought that Big Brown could have gotten beaten at Belmont? Are you kidding me?
Nobody.
That horse was the biggest
he's a lot.
I mean, he was an absolute lock. So is Al have another any more of a lock than Big Brown? No way. No way was he anywhere near that much of a certainty. So if Big Brown can get beaten at Belmont, and any kind of horse could get beaten at Belmont. So, you know, I'm sure Al have another stacks up to some of those other horses, but, you know, he would have been the overwhelming favourite today, and I think some of that money would have just been people betting because they want to bet on the Triple Crown winner. But it would have been a very tough race for him to win. I certainly wasn't one of the ones that was handing him this ready on a plate. If he'd won the race today, he would have won the Triple Crown absolutely the hard way. He'd have beaten more horses in all three races than any other Triple Crown winner for a start. But this is a good crop of three-year-olds, and I don't think today's Belmont was a gimme for Al have another by a long stretch. Some of these horses that are racing this afternoon in that race are very, very good horses.
Oh, okay, now, Alex, you know, we can, you know, get into this race now. You know, it's hard. You know, Al have another, certainly not going to be a part of it. But taking Al have another out, and also you remember as well, there's no Bullmeister who's finished second in both Triple Crown in both races previous to this. Where does this race stand now? You know, who I know Doolahan is the odds on favorite, but
yeah.
I would have to think that this race is absolutely wide open at this point.
Well, I'll pick you three horses. Doolahan won't be odds on favorite. He'll go off maybe 2-1, 3-1. But he'll be favorite. And he ran a very credible race in the Derby, finishing third. And what you can argue that, you know, he's had the nice 5 weeks. He put in a very sharp work last weekend. So apparently he's training very well. So he's definitely a credible favorite for the race. I'm obviously a huge fan of Union Rags, who ran a very disappointing race in the Derby. Lots and lots of excuses, but, you know, excuses don't make the race. If you don't win, you don't win, right? He ran seventh after a horrible start and just a lot of traffic trouble. He now has a different jockey, Johnny Velasquez, who, you know, if you're going to switch jockeys going into the Belmont, you cannot get a better rider than Johnny Velasquez.
Yeah, talk about that. Now, Velasquez is a Hall of Fame rider. We all know that. Were they just down on the previous rider? Did they blame the previous rider for Union Rags' finish? Was this a case of, you know what, we got a chance to get a Hall of Fame rider, let's go out there and get him?
Right. I mean, I think certainly Julian Le Perroux, who rode Union Rags in his last couple of races, is an extremely good jockey. And Michael Matz, the trainer of Union Rags, will be first one to tell you that. But the reality is, in his last two races aboard Union Rags, there have been trouble in both races. And, you know, it's just a hunch, or whatever you want to call it, that Johnny Velasquez came open to the Belmont and they wanted to try something else with Union Rags, and they took that option. And Johnny Velasquez has always been, ever since Union Rags sort of won the Champagne Stakes at Belmont last year. I mean, Velasquez has been a huge fan of this horse. He couldn't ride him at the point where he might have become available to ride him at the beginning of the year because he was committed to go to Dubai when Union Rags was going to be racing. But nevertheless, Velasquez is aboard. He came down to Fairhill last weekend. He worked Union Rags. I was there. I watched it. I talked to Velasquez afterwards. And this camp has a lot of confidence. This horse worked very well last weekend. And he'll run, I think he'll run a great race. And then the third horse that is also going to take a lot of money at the windows, and these will be basically the first three favorites. The third horse is Painter. And you talked about Bodemeister chasing I'll have another in the Derby and the Preakness and just coming up short. Well, Painter comes from the same connections, trainer Bob Backer, same owner.
Right.
And honestly, early in these horses' two-year-old careers, these connections, or at least I believe Baffert or one of the connections was thought Painter was their top horse, not Bodemeister. And Painter won a real nice race on the Preakness undercard. So I would imagine Painter will run a terrific race this afternoon too. Those will be the three favorites. And you know, assuming that neither of them has real distance limitations, that's one of the odd things about the Belmont. It's a mile and a half, so that creates a sort of a bit of a different wrinkle. Those three horses, I would look to see run great races.
You bring up the mile and a half. Obviously, this is a race, it seems to be two things, endurance, number one, and three, finishing kick.
Yeah.
What is the biggest mistake that jockeys make technically when they race here? You know, what caught, you know, when you look back at the videotape and watch the race and what have you, I'm sure you do, what is something that caught, what costs a lot of these horses the race when running on this track?
Right. I mean, I think there's two things, or let's say three things. One is if you just break out of the gate and go too fast.
Right.
And you could argue that that's what Ronnie Franklin did on Spectacular Bid. You know, he'd never ridden the race going a mile and a half before, and you know, gates opened and he went. you know, Ronnie will be the first to tell you that he probably contributed to the horse getting beat for that. So, I mean, you're going a mile and a half, you definitely don't want to be breaking out the gate as if the race is a mile and an eighth. So you've got to conserve some energy. That being said, the race can be a little bit tricky. If nobody wants to take the lead and the leader gets a slow early pace, they could steal the race. So as a jockey, when they come out the gate, you don't automatically think, you know, I've got to take back. You've got to be a good judge of pace to know if the race is going fast or slow and then make your decisions. So, you know, there will be times where someone, a rider in this race could actually come out the gate and go wire to wire and sort of fool the rest of the jockeys because they just presume they didn't want to be on the lead. So if they can get a slower pace, that would be good. Then I think the final thing is just a bit of a hard race to ride if you're a jockey that's not so used to the racetrack itself, because whilst the race is unique in as much as it's a mile and a half, the racetrack also is unique because it's a mile and a half round instead of the more typical 1 mile racetracks like Churchill Downs and Pimlico. So, you know, when you're going into the final turn at Belmont, you still have a long way to go versus if you're going into the final turn at Pimlico or Churchill Downs, you know, you're at the 3/8 pole and you start to move your horse and start to send it. At Belmont, you probably don't want to be doing that yet because you've got a much further distance to go. So just kind of knowing where you are on the racetrack and its implications, I think, is important for out-of-town jockeys, which, again, is, you know, a lot of these jockeys riding in this race, they actually do ride at Belmont a lot. And having Johnny Velasquez on Union Rags, I think, is a big advantage now for Michael Matz.
So you want to be patient, but you don't want to be too patient, because I saw
something
a couple of days ago, and it was an amazing stat that out of the last 44 winners, 29 of them have either been first or second at the quarter pole.
Right. That's very possible.
So a lot of horses, there are a lot of jockeys or horses that get themselves in trouble, you know, not so much trying to break out the gate, but just not being aggressive enough, gauging, you know, you said the pace.
Right. Nobody, you know, unless you get some extreme sort of outsiders gunning to the lead early to enforce a really fast pace, I mean, you're going to get a more moderate pace because of the distance of the race. And that may require the better horses to stay quite handy in the race and not to be too far back. Conventional wisdom would say longer race, be far back, and then come with a big, long closing kick. But that's not necessarily always the case, simply because the race might set up with a much softer pace than the other races. So, tactics aside, because it's a mile and a half race, you're going to get less problems coming out of the gate and getting early position. because it'll be a slower run race at the beginning. So the real troubles that Union Rags had in the Derby, I'd be shocked if he had those kind of troubles in this race, regardless of who was on him.
How about the ideal that, you know, in recent memory, in recent years, the Belmont has produced some long shot winners and into double digit winners. Give me a couple of double digit long shot winners that could possibly break through in this particular race.
I mean, that's the thing. It's very difficult to do that because typically when a long shot wins, they're a long shot for a reason. You can't pick them out. And, you know, it's the nature of this race. It's a mile and a half. These horses haven't gone a mile and a half, and one of these longer shots may just step up and get the job done. So, you know, I mean, people have been touting Street Life a little bit, but, you know, he'll be sort of 10 or 12 to 1, maybe. So he won't be that long a shot. Adigon, maybe he'll be a longer shot from Kendrick.
Well, Street Life is 8 to 1.
Yeah. So you can't really call that a long shot, I suppose. Honestly, you know, if you're going to bet multiples and throw in three or four horses, you've got to just throw a dart at this and pick at least one horse that's one of the outsiders and then throw a couple of the favorites in there and throw one of them out at your own choosing. But I really do believe, like I say, I think in some of the more recent Belmonts, other than the favorite or the horse that's going for the Triple Crown or whatever it might be, you've had a bit of a weaker field behind those horses.
Right.
Today, I truly don't think that's the case. I think Union Rags and Dollahan, both Grade 1 stakes winners, these are both already proven very good horses.
Right.
And Painter seems to be a very lightly raced potential superstar. So you've got three very, very good horses in this race. Without Al Havenother, if he was running, it would have been a Belmont for the ages, honestly, in my book.
And you just mentioned that's a very good point. So this, you think this is a race for the favorites? This is going to be a, you know,
I think you've got three very legitimate race horses in this race. So, you know, if all three throw in duds, then one of your outsiders will come up and win it. But usually, if you've got three real good horses in a race, at least one or two of them are going to run their race, right? You know, in the past, when you've got these outsiders coming up and winning, you've had one or two real legitimate horses just don't run their race, the outsider wins. But, you know, it's a numbers game. You've got three of them. I would be surprised and a little bit upset if one of those three doesn't get the job done.
I mean, it just made me think about if I could imagine this race. How great would this race be with
It would have been a fantastic race. Bodemeister, maybe. His real issue was going to be the distance in this race. Bodemeister might be the best mile horse out of this crop by far. The mile and a quarter and the mile and 3/16 kind of found him out at the end, and the mile and a half, I think, this was never going to be his horse race.
You don't think Bodemeister would have been a factor? You don't think Bodemeister would have been a major factor in this race?
No. I just think, you know, he had two hard races in the Derby and the Preakness anyway, but I think Baffert was probably always thinking that the Belmont wouldn't be his better race of the three Triple Crown races. But I think if I'll have another run this afternoon, we'd have had four real legitimate top-class 3-year-olds going at it, it would have been one of the best Belmonts for a long, long time.
Two last one, Alex. One, who do you like and why?
Well, I'm sticking with Union Rags because I know the horse. I've seen him. I think he's a little bit of a better quality horse than anything I've been around for a while. And I would just love to see him redeem some of his reputation by winning this race. So it's a little bit of a bit of a biased pick. But having said that, I really do believe this is a different kind of horse. So I'm going to go for Union Rags to get the job done. But if he doesn't, I think Painter, you know, might pull a what some might characterize as a mild upset, but I think Painter will probably take plenty of money too.
Do you see, you know, with what happened to I'll Have Another, do you see any way that the sport will, you know, stretch out these races in the future from go from maybe from 5 weeks to 6 weeks? So that's not going to happen.
No, I mean, I think I'm a big believer. We have a lot of things we need to fix in our sport. There's no doubt about that. And I'll be the first to admit what some of those issues are. But if you change the nature of the Triple Crown, then a Triple Crown winner, after you change the nature of the Triple Crown, how do you compare that Triple Crown winner with
to others?
Triple Crown winners?
That's a fair point.
You've
that's
changed the rules
point.
Of the game. So I'm a firm believer. Make it hard to win. And someone will win it, no doubt in my mind. Before Secretariat won it, there was a 30-year gap. So I don't subscribe to this, oh, we don't breed them like that anymore. It's going to be impossible to never see another Triple Crown winner. I just think things go in cycles, and we're coming hopefully towards the end of a drought, and we'll see a winner of the Triple Crown here in the next year or two. I mean, you know, the list of 11 horses that went to the Belmont with a chance to win the Triple Crown and didn't get it done since affirmed. If someone told you that list, they didn't get it done and they're all odds-on favorites, I mean, that's a ridiculous anomaly in terms of statistics. It'll happen, I'm sure.
And one last one, Alex. Do you think that there are those – now, obviously, we don't want – and, you know, the thing that happened, we haven't talked about this, but the thing that happened with the HBO series Luck was just a tragedy with those what they did to those horses and how it continuously happened. But do you think that there are those in the sport who are secretly kind of happy that, you know, that this horse, that I'll Have Another did not win the Triple Crown based on the fact that had he won the Triple Crown, that this it could have been tainted? And Doug O'Neill, with Doug O'Neill, with the drug stuff, do you think that those, that they're not all, you know, that this normally is still devastating, of course, but are there those in the sport that are saying maybe this wasn't the worst thing for the sport as a whole moving forward?
No. Yeah, I mean, Doug O'Neill's a bit of a divisive character. There are those that are thrilled with his ability to do what he's been able to do with this horse, and there are people that don't think that he's the role model we should put up there as the person that can get the Triple Crown done. So depending on which side of the fence you're on, you're rooted one way or the other. But the bigger issue for most people is focusing on the horse itself rather than its connections. So whilst, you know, Doug O'Neill, he has some baggage, but so does his owner have some baggage, and everybody loved the jock. So you had a bit of a balance there. The jock everybody loved. The owner has baggage. The trainer has baggage. And are they the people that you want to be the next group to win the Triple Crown? Well, some did and some didn't, for sure. You know, this whole idea, too, that the sport needs a Triple Crown winner, and that's what we need to get us back into the sort of, you know, into the consciousness of sports fans and stuff like that, I think is bullshit, honestly. We need a lot more than a Triple Crown winner to fix our sport. So I read a quote the other day. It's like, our sport getting a Triple Crown winner is kind of like a hobo getting a sandwich. Like, we've got a lot more stuff to fix than having a Triple Crown winner to create some buzz for a week or two.
I completely agree with that. But, you know, you need to, before you focus on winning a Triple Crown, need to get the Doug O'Neill out of the sport. That's what that would be a nice start, and focus on, you know, the care of these horses. So I completely agree with that whole logic. I mean, a Triple Crown winner would be a bonus for the sport. Just
right.
get the dirtiness out of the sport. Because right now, I'll be honest with you, Alex, the sport has a boxing type feel to it.
Yeah.
In terms of
yeah.
some of the dirtiness. I mean, Doug O'Neill is like a Don King or a dirty promoter, basically, in many
yeah.
ways. I mean, hey, it did have that kind of circus atmosphere toward in terms of how this race was being promoted and all the stuff that was going around it, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, I will agree with you. I'm not going to disagree with you. I'm a horse welfare kind of dude, and this, that, and the other, and I'm all about the best for the horse. The only thing that I will sort of argue a little, not necessarily argue, but think, is whether Doug O'Neill has changed his behavior. I don't know if he has or he hasn't. But the,
what is
the
perception
the
of him? I'm sorry to cut you off, Alex. What is the perception of him within, like, amongst the other trainers, owners, the people within the sport? Forget about the media. We know what the media
right.
thinks about. Like, what is it, like, in terms of the people that you talk to, closest, that you know, jockeys and what have you? What is the perception of Doug O'Neill as a whole?
I mean, I think the perception is he's a very affable kind of guy. Now, I think he has gone on record as being the first to admit that he's made mistakes in the past. And, you know, he now puts the horse first in everything that he does. Now, the proof of that will be in his record going forward. And can you forgive someone for their past behavior? I don't think you can ever give anyone a free pass for their past behavior. But you do have to recognize that people can change. I don't know if Doug O'Neill's changed. I don't know enough about the detail. I read media, and I kind of have been around people that know him or whatever. But the fact of the matter is, our sport doesn't need people that behave like Doug O'Neill used to behave, if that's the right way to put it. We need to get rid of that behavior completely, whether it's milkshaking horses or whether it's dropping unsound horses through the claim box so that they become someone else's problem. To me, that's the bigger issue here, of which Doug has been guilty of in the past, and perhaps he doesn't do that anymore. I don't know. But the point, back to your earlier point, is, yeah, sure, there were plenty of people that would have been less excited about this Triple Crown winner, given his connections. And it wasn't just Doug O'Neill either. It was the owner has a little bit of baggage too. You know, people, having said that, there was another camp that was really excited about the potential for a Triple Crown winner. So I would say it was a little bit split. Personally, I think it would have been cool to have a Triple Crown winner, but, you know, if we weren't going to have one, I hoped it was Union Rags that was going to spoil it, because I think that would have been cool too.
No question about it. Alex, as always, thanks for joining me, and certainly we'll keep in touch as far as what this race looks like in, you know, Breeders' Cup in, what, November. So we'll certainly get you on to talk about that, as that should be exciting as well.
Let's hope so. Fingers crossed. So, yeah, I really appreciate it. And that's, you know, again, I'm rooting for Union Rags, and hopefully Union Rags then come back and shows in the Breeders' Cup he's a real deal.
All right, Alex, you take it easy.
Yeah, take care, mate. Cheers.
All right.
Bye.
That was, of course, Alex Brown. I'm talking about the upcoming Belmont Stakes, of course, tonight. I want to say 6:40 they're going to post. And listen, there's no two ways about it. When you have a horse that is on the verge of something that is one of the most rarefied feats in all the sports, not just racing, sports, it takes the air out of the balloon. I mean, this race, the viewership will be down, attendance will be down, just the interest overall is going to be down with no I'll have another. I mean, to be honest with you, at least 10 or 15 minutes of that interview would have been, that entire interview might have been on I'll have another if he was racing, to be honest with you. I mean, I had stuff, you know, comparing him historically to other horses. That definitely hurts the race without question. All the distractions leading up to it hurts the race. But he made a good point as far as the race. The Belmont still has a history of being an exciting race with the mile and a half, a test of endurance. He made a good point. Listen, it is a very tough thing to gauge because of the distance. You start too fast, forget about it. But you can't sit around here and pace yourself too much, because at the quarter pole, you better be within striking distance. I gave you that stat that 29 out of the last 44 winners were either first or second at the quarter pole. So you had to be up there once you hit that quarter pole. Once you hit that quarter pole, and of course, you know, and then of course finish strong. I mean, the finishing, you know, the finishing kick, it definitely will make a huge difference. Huge difference, and that's why this is the ultimate. You know, that's why the Triple Crown is so hard. I mean, they made is you know it's not by accident that the Belmont is the last race, because it's the hardest one. It is absolutely the hardest one out of the three races to run, because of the distance and because of the fact that, you know, this will be 3 weeks, three races in 5 weeks, which is, you know, we've seen a number of horses, we've seen a couple of trainers pull their horses out and say, you know what, we're not racing. Bodemeister said, you know what, even though I finished second in the first two races and had a chance to win at least one of the major races, you know what, we'll sit this one out. 31 minutes after the 11 o'clock hour, when we return, we'll have React Quotes, and Are You Kidding Me? We'll be right back. After the 11 o'clock hour on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, your host, Cyril Quinn, taking you to the bottom of the hour. It's 347-215-6180 is your call number. Of course, big weekend sports, a lot going on. I mean, French Open final, Maria Sharapova already won her fourth French Open over Sarah Errani. Her fourth Grand Slam, completes the career Grand Slam. For women's tennis and women's tennis, you'll have Federer and Djokovic tomorrow. Djokovic and Nadal tomorrow. Djokovic beat Federer in straight sets. Federer will never win another Grand Slam, unless you have a tournament where Djokovic and Nadal both get hurt. It's only Federer's winning a Grand Slam, or they both lose before he faces them. He can't beat either one. He's at the point in his career where he can't beat either one of those players. I mean, he's, you know, 31, 32 years old. He's not supposed to be able to beat either one of those players. Those guys are, in their mid, you know, 24 and 25 years old. They're in the prime of their careers. Tennis is a young man's sport. The Djokovic-Nadal match should be interesting from the standpoint of, in Grand Slam events, Djokovic has owned Nadal in finals. But the last two times they've met on clay this season, Nadal has won. Now, the last one, Djokovic was not healthy in that match. Very interesting to see this matchup. Djokovic looking for his first French Open. Djokovic has the opportunity to complete the career Grand Slam at 24 years old, which would be remarkable. He's won Djokovic, and also if Djokovic wins this, a lot of history on the line in terms of this match. If Djokovic wins, he then becomes the first player, I believe, since Rod Laver to hold all four Grand Slams at the same time, which is unheard of in this day and age in tennis, with how many, you know, with the parity that not parity in tennis, but just how hard That is, you know, nobody, like, to win three majors in one year is remarkable, but to hold all four Grand Slams at the same time would just be just ridiculous. Even Federer, that's the one thing Federer hasn't done in his career, is hold all four Grand Slams at the same time. He's done everything else but that. Nadal has a chance to win his seventh French Open, which will break the tie with the great Bjorn Borg. I would give a slight edge to Nadal, because this is his house, undefeated in French Open finals. But again, Djokovic knows how to beat him. Djokovic has owned him in Grand Slam events. It should be a classic match between those two. The React quote of the week: Joe's a free agent now. That is, of course, Jeffrey Lurie talking about Joe Banner. Joe Banner, of course, is still with the Eagles, but has been moved. He'll be Jeffrey Lurie's advisor. Now, remember, these two have a long-standing friendship going back 44 years. Banner had been with the organization since 1994, had been the team president for 14 years. There are talks that there was a power struggle between he and Andy Reid. Banner, of course, brushed that off in various interviews. Let's put Joe Banner aside for a minute. You know, he, you know, claims he wants to own a team, that he has other things that he wants to do, as far as in terms of running a team and running. You know, he says he wants to do other things, but put him aside for a second. The new president, Smolenski, is going to be in charge of the business aspect of the team. Andy Reid is now the guy. Okay. Now, you say, well, Howie Roseman as well. Yeah, Howie Roseman will negotiate some contracts. Andy Reid is the guy. It begins this. The Eagle organization basically begins and ends with Andy Reid at this point. Or maybe begins with Andy Reid and ends with Jeffrey Lurie. All the pressure is on Andy Reid. I heard somebody say, is it possible for somebody to gain power and be on the hot seat at the same time? Yes. Because Andy Reid has gained more power, and he's absolutely on the hot seat. So if the Eagles lose in the first round of the playoffs, or somehow again don't make the playoffs, Andy Reid is gone. I think that is the subliminal message being sent from Jeffrey Lurie to Andy Reid. Like, okay, you want all power, you have all power. What are you going to do with it? There's no question about it in my mind that this all will fall on Andy Reid. But again, if you're Andy Reid, it's not the worst thing. If you go out, then you go out your way. You go out doing it your way, rather than, you know, having Joe Banner call the shots or somebody, Howie Roseman, calling shots. No, this is all, you know, Andy Reid's going to make the moves. He's going to decide, you know, personnel decisions. You know what I mean? So this is, if you're Andy Reid, you can't complain. You can't. I won't regret game seven. That is, of course, comes from LeBron James, who had a memorable game six. But again, 45 points, 15 rebounds, 5 assists. Only Wilt Chamberlain has ever done that in his career. But again, nobody cares about his MVPs. Nobody cares about the guarding stats he puts up. This game seven, and LeBron, averaged 36 points a game in his career in game seven, so has lost both of them, but lost to the better team. This time, this is the first time he'll enter a game seven with him being on the better team. Miami is better than Boston. This game seven will be a career-defining moment for LeBron James. That's all there is to it. If he goes out there and plays, he can play a great three quarters. He has a bad fourth quarter, a bad 5 minutes in the fourth quarter, and they lose game seven. People are going to be talking about it until he wins a championship. People are going to be talking about it until he wins a championship. Because that's the pressure that you put on yourself when you go out there and predict that you're going to win seven championships. I like the slogan they had a couple of days ago when they were previewing the Heat Celtics game six: just get one. That's a good one. Just forget about Forget about 5, 6, or 7. Just get one. When we return, we'll have another segment of Are You Kidding Me? That's coming up on this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. We'll be right back. Saturday Morning Wake Up Call, 42 minutes after the 11 o'clock hour. Again, busy sports weekend. You also have game 5 of the Stanley Cup. Devils sound confident, but still down 3-1 to the Los Angeles Kings. The Kings, of course, this is game 5. The Kings have not lost a road game in this postseason, which is remarkable for hockey, for any sport, for that matter. Look for the Kings to take this game out. I don't see, Kings haven't lost two straight games all postseason. Only lost, 3 games in the whole entire postseason. So they've been the dominant team of this postseason. That was 1-4, but I don't look for that to continue. I don't think forget about any chance of a comeback here. Expect this series to be over. Over tonight, in which, again, a series that, frankly, nobody cares about. I mean, let's be honest. Nobody cares about the series. Nobody cares about the New Jersey Devils. Nobody even knows who the LA Kings are. Unless, Jonathan Quick, unless you're just, you have to be a diehard hockey fan. I mean, nobody cares about the series. Game 7 tonight, Boston at Miami. Boston 21-7 all time in Game 7. Miami 0-2. We'll talk more about it after this Are You Kidding Me segment. Drew Brees apparently has been given a new offer by the Saints at $19 million a year. There's some talks that they're in negotiations this weekend. And that a deal could be negotiated. It could be finalized by Monday.
Are you kidding me?
There also have been talks that they are nowhere near close to making a deal, and that the real deadline would be July 16th. That would be the deadline for doing long term contracts. So there's really no rush. I don't expect a deal to be done by this weekend, because there's no reason for a deal to be done by this weekend if you're Drew Brees, or if you're the New Orleans Saints. If the deadline to get long term deals done is July 16th, why would you be sweating bullets on June 9th, 10th, or June 9th? The bottom line is the Saints, with everything they have going on, with the bounty situation, Sean Payton, Greg Williams, Jonathan Villman, to say at least, Drew Brees. This deal should have been done a long time ago. And the idea that we're still talking about it right now in the middle of June, at the beginning of June, is remarkable to me, considering, he is New Orleans. Drew Brees is the Saints. Make him the highest paid quarterback of all time – and keep it moving. I don't think there's, you know, what I don't think. I don't get what the Saints are trying to do. I didn't get this before all this thing. I didn't get it before all this stuff went down as far as the bounties and what have you. I definitely don't get it at right now. And if I'm Drew Brees, I will hold out as long as possible until I get a deal. I wouldn't sign a tender. I'm not going to a tender or want to get any tender offers. You know, I'm holding out for, you know, 21 million dollars a year, wherever, whoever. I want to be the highest paid quarterback in the NFL from Drew Brees, period. Because I mean as much to that franchise as any player means to any team in the NFL. Tiger Woods is the odds-on favorite to win the U.S. Open at 6-1.
Are you kidding me?
When the last time Tiger Woods won a Grand Slam? I mean, can somebody tell me, explain to me that? When the last time Tiger Woods won a Grand Slam? It's been a while. It's been about, what, 4 years? Yeah, it is 4 years. Obama was in office last time Tiger won a Grand Slam. George Bush was in office. So it's been a pretty good minute. Now all of a sudden he wins the Memorial, which, you know, okay, Jack Nicholson, Nicholas founded the tournament, built the course. Nice win. He hit the ball straight, played well. But all of a sudden now we're supposed to believe in Tiger Woods? Didn't he win the, you know, he won, you know, Arnold Palmer's tournament before the Masters? How'd that work out? Not too well, did it? No, it didn't. I don't expect Tiger Woods to do anything in this up-and-coming U.S. Open. Again, I have to believe it to when I see it, and I just need to see him win a major before I believe that he's anywhere close to being, you know, back. I just, you know, I don't, him winning these non-major tournaments, I mean, they basically mean nothing. From a historical perspective, or from, you know, maybe they mean something, you know, I know he passed Nicholas on the all-time list of Nicholas on the all-time list of career wins, and that's a great accomplishment. But again, it's all about, you know, it's all about the number 18. That's how many majors that Jack Nicklaus has had. Nicklaus has. Tiger is stuck on 14, and I think will remain stuck on 14, even following this week at the U.S. Open. The NFL is going to begin hiring replacement officials for the upcoming 2012 season.
Are you kidding me?
Officiating in the NFL wasn't the greatest last year with the regular officials. There's no way you can go into the season with replacement officials. With the speed of the game, with so many calls that, I mean, there's so many calls that get, there's so many tough calls to make in the NFL. Judgment calls. I mean, there's no way you can have replacement officials in the NFL. I don't know, you know, again, NFL is a, you know, billion-dollar corporation. Give the officials, I mean, give them their money. I don't know what, you know, what they're fighting over. I get the whole point from the NFL. The NFL is coming from that these officials are not full-time, you know, I mean, they only do it 5 months a year. It's only 16 games and, what, 4 playoff games, 5 playoff games. It's only 20 games. It's not like the NBA or the NHL with 82 games. I get that. It's not real full-time officials. But you can't have replacement officials. Yeah, I mean, you got to put the best possible product on the field. I mean, there have been arguments that the NFL should hire full-time officials. I mean, the guys that they have, you know, they do other professions because they only work 5 months a year. You know, a lot of those guys are lawyers. They have their own businesses. And there's a question that the NFL should hire year-round full-time officials. That debate has been going on for a long time now. So now you're going to go from, you know, not doing that to not having real officials. You can't have minor league officials. I mean, there's a reason why those guys are reffing in the, you know, Canadian Football League or the Arena League. They're not good enough to be NFL officials. And you got fans paying too much money for DirecTV packages, season ticket holders. You can't lower the quality of the best product in sports. Right now, you have the best product in sports. in terms of the NFL. You do. When we return, we will finish where we started. We'll talk about Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals, Boston and Miami. We'll be right back. Hour on this special 90-minute edition of the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call. A busy show so far. You heard from Alex Brown. We've talked about the Belmont. Of course, I'll have another out of the race, unfortunately, ruining the Triple Crown. Eliminating any possibility of a Triple Crown winner for the first time since 1978. French Open Finals. Maria Sharapova wins her fourth major, gets a career Grand Slam. You'll have Djokovic and Nadal tomorrow. Stanley Cup Finals Game 1 tonight. Kings trying to wrap up the series and become the most unlikely Stanley Cup winner of all time as an eighth seed, by the numbers. Though they have been the dominant team in the postseason so far. You have that Euro Cup kicked off yesterday, so that'll be ongoing for the next month. So a busy NFL course. Roger Goodell will be allowed to rule on the Saints bounty. Vilma and a couple of other players, the four other players, will meet with the Goodell June 18th, and good luck with that. So a lot going on in the world of sports, especially in particular this weekend. Interleague baseball, some great series with Boston and Washington. The Yankees, Mets, Tampa, Miami. So, a lot going on, but it all takes second place to what's going to transpire tonight at around 8:30, where you'll have Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals, Celtics Heat. You've had two overtime games. You've had a couple blowouts. You've seen a little bit of everything in this series. You've seen Rondo be dominant with a 44-point game. See LeBron James put up Will Chamberlain-like numbers. This has been a very entertaining series, and it all will culminate tomorrow, tonight. And it's going to be the end of an era, one way or the other. Either the big three in Boston as a group are going to be done, or Miami's big three. We don't know who, outside LeBron, we don't know who, whether it be Wade or Bosh, They're going to be moved. One of these teams will not look the same, nowhere near the same, come next year. The loser. And you can make a case that even Boston wins this game and loses the NBA Finals, that they would make some changes. But certainly, they lose this game, there are going to be some major changes made to that franchise. And I think the pressure squarely rides. I think the pressure on both teams. You can't say just because, a home team home team you would think has more under pressure because they're certainly expected to win. But pressure's on both teams. I mean, the Celtics do badly want to win another championship and to complete their legacy in terms of this five-year run that they've had, which has been an excellent run, to say the least. Miami, of course, cannot afford – I mean, Miami has to win this game. I mean, they have to win this game. Their franchise, of course, can't afford a second straight year. They basically be taking a step back. Now, they're going to make the excuse about Chris Bosh, winning what have you, but you know what? That's what they signed up for when you built your team around three players and nobody else. So that you take that risk and one of those guys getting hurt, your team not being what it has the potential to be. But Chris Bosh, the excuse of Chris Bosh is out of the window because he's played the last two games now. So expect Bosh to go anywhere probably from 30-35 minutes. LeBron, I think, would play unless it's an outright blowout, will play the whole game. Key to this game is Paul Pierce. Paul Pierce has to be Paul Pierce. Now, I'm not saying Paul Pierce of 2008 when he scored 41 in a game 7 against Cleveland and LeBron, but I'm talking about a Paul Pierce who, gets me 18 to 25 and gets me about 10 to 12 points in the fourth quarter. I'm talking about that Paul Pierce and stays on the floor and makes LeBron sweat, break a sweat. Because LeBron, in game 6, LeBron didn't break a sweat. I mean, he hit some tough shots, but for the most part, he was getting to the rim at will. He had, I don't know how many dunks he had, at least three or four dunks, had a ton of layups, got inside the paint, did whatever he wanted to do. And again, Paul Pierce plays him as well as any player in the league because Paul Pierce, number one, knows him so well. And number two, Paul Pierce is strong enough to not allow LeBron to basically bully him all over the floor. And on the other side, LeBron has to guard Paul Pierce. LeBron cannot wrestle on defense. Playing against a great offensive player, sometimes your best offense, your best defense is your offense because you make them play both ends of the court. So, again, Paul Pierce is essential to what the Celtics, to the Celtics' chances of winning tonight. Again, I like Miami myself. I can see this game being a 10- to 15-point game. I really think Miami's going to have their way. I think Celtics blew their chance in game 6. I mean, I thought they, outside of LeBron James, I didn't think anybody from Miami played well. I just think Boston was god-awful. And there's no way that one man in the playoffs, there's no way that one man should be able to beat you. Regular season happens all the time on any given night. Not in the playoffs. One man should not be able to beat a team, especially at this stage of the playoffs, talking about Eastern Conference Finals, NBA Finals. LeBron could have got 45. Celtics still should have been able to handle their business and close the heat out. And I thought they were. I thought they were going to close the heat out. But with that being said, again, I'll take the heat to beat the Thunder. We did not get a lot of chance to talk about what the Thunder did. Certainly when the finals start. The finals start Tuesday. We'll talk a lot about Oklahoma City and about what they did. It was just a tremendous, easy team to root for, and certainly they are the favorites right now to win the NBA championship. Kevin Durant, James Harden, and Russell Westbrook and company looking like a well-oiled machine heading into the playoffs. They had one of the great runs in playoff history, beating Dallas, the Lakers, and, of course, finishing off San Antonio. So we'll certainly get to them over the course of this week. That's going to wrap it up for this latest edition of the Saturday Morning Wake-Up Call. I will see you Tuesday, post-game, game 1 of the NBA Finals. I'll see you then. Have a great weekend.